shows in the field at the time. And it's, this study called The Political Economy of American Foreign Policy goes into these topics, and they actually define communism in its operative usage. They say that the threat of the communist powers, the essential threat of the communist powers, is that they refuse to allow their economies to complement the industrial economies of the West. Translating it into plain English, they do not understand that their function is to serve us. And in fact, that's a good operational definition of communist as it's actually used. Doesn't matter where they come from. If they do that, meaning falling under the heresy that intelligence noted, they're communists. Well, Kennan went on to explain the means that we have to use against our enemies who fall prey to this heresy that threatens our resources, which happen to be in their countries. Quote, "The final answer might be an unpleasant one, but we should not hesitate before police repression by the local government. This is not shameful, since the communists are essentially traitors. It's better to have a strong regime in power than a liberal government if it is indulgent and relaxed and penetrated by communists." Again, the term communist being used in the technical sense. Well, all of this is, remember, I'm sampling the dovish side of the spectrum here. All of this is totally excluded from, and virtually excluded from, the scholarly literature, which and there's a rich scholarly literature on this, including on Kennan, and it typically claims, in fact, universally claims, that Kennan had no general geopolitical conceptions, just a kind of a vague kind of moral concern. The people who say that, like John Lewis Gaddis, know perfectly well that these documents exist. In fact, in this case, I happen to be quoting from a collection of documents edited by Gaddis, who wrote the standard scholarly work on Kennan. So he knows it exists, but obviously you can't tell people that. Well, these views illustrate the spectrum of opinion among planners, and the documentary record pretty well falls within that spectrum, as you can discover by checking it. Occasionally you can find some qualifications. So for example, there's an influential study of April 1947, secret again, which observed that, about aid, it observed that foreign aid should be restricted to countries of, I'm quoting now, countries of primary strategic importance to the United States, excepting in those rare instances which present an opportunity for the United States to gain worldwide approbation by an act strikingly humanitarian. Now, this stance, again, is not unique to the United States, and it did not arise in the post-war period. So let's return to Woodrow Wilson, who, as you know, was the great apostle of self-determination and who celebrated this doctrine by invading Mexico and invading Haiti and the Dominican Republic, where his warriors murdered and destroyed, reestablished virtual slavery, demolished the political system while establishing the basis for murderous and corrupt dictatorships, and placed the area firmly into the hands of U.S. investors. Again, all of this pretty much suppressed in the even the scholarly literature, but certainly the general literature. Haiti was in the news recently, and much talk, although if you look back, there was much talk about traditional U.S. benevolence towards Haiti, nothing about the truth, which is, as I have just briefly described it. Woodrow Wilson, his Secretary of State, Robert Lansing, once wrote a memorandum explaining the meaning of the Monroe Doctrine. Wilson decided that it would be, in his words, impolitic to issue the memorandum, but he found its argument unanswerable. That was his word, very impressed by it. Here's what it said. In its advocacy of the Monroe Doctrine, the United States considers its own interests. The integrity of other American nations is an incident, not an end. While this may seem based on selfishness alone, the author of the doctrine had no higher or more generous motive in its declaration. The task at hand at that time, the document went on, was European interference in the American continent through financial and other means, which had to be opposed, and Wilson's practice, in fact, opposed it, for example, by including Britain, which was the evil empire of the day, excluding them from Central American oil concessions. The major change after World War II is that the United States was able to apply these principles on a global scale, given its power, and of course the evil empire from which it had to defend itself was no longer the Huns or the British. Well, Kennan's nutshell presentation of U.S. foreign policy did not emerge from a vacuum. It reflected a much broader geopolitical analysis that had been developed by elite groups and planning studies through the war. There were study groups of the State Department, including virtually all their top planners, and the Council on Foreign Relations, which provides the main business input into foreign policy planning, through the war, 1939 to 1945. And they formulated kind of a theory of what the post-war world should look like. They formulated the concept of what they called the grand area, a region which they said should be subordinated to the needs of the American economy. It should include the Western Hemisphere, the Far East, the former British Empire, which was being dismantled and subordinated to the United States. It was to be extended to a total global system, if possible, surely including Western Europe and the incomparable energy resources of the Middle East, which were then passing into American hands as we pushed out our rivals, France and England. Now, these guiding geopolitical conceptions explain a good deal of what has been happening in the world. If they're not understood, what takes place will appear to be a series of random errors, inconsistencies, confusions, traceable to the failings of a political leadership that is in fact succeeding quite brilliantly in its assigned chores. The Third World was to be incorporated within the grand area, so was Europe. Europe posed problems, but Soviet aggression was considered a very remote eventuality. The CIA concluded in 1947 that the problem of Europe was not Soviet aggression, which no intelligence expected, but rather the possibility of economic collapse in Western Europe and the consequent accession to power of communist elements. It's one reason for the Marshall Plan, which was also motivated by the needs of U.S. industry for export markets and overseas investment. That came out of Kennan's office, incidentally. Kennan's advice was also followed with regard to Japan. That was the so-called reverse course, which took place in 1947. It terminated the early steps towards democratization in Japan, which were taken by General MacArthur's military administration. The reverse course suppressed the unions and other democratic forces and placed the country firmly in the hands of corporate elements that had backed Japanese fascism, a system of state and private power that still endures. There's no time to go into it, but the background for planning for the Vietnam War takes place in that context. It takes place in the context of ensuring that the grand area will include Southeast Asia, accommodating itself to Japan. Kennan's planning staff, again, we're talking about the doves, explained that Southeast Asia must fulfill its major function as a source of raw materials and a market for Japan and Western Europe. They got to understand that that's their function. Vietnamese nationalists didn't understand it. They had to therefore be smashed. The threat was not that they were going to conquer anyone, but that there might be a dangerous demonstration effect of national independence, which might spread throughout the region, same threat that arises in Nicaragua and elsewhere repeatedly. Incidentally, I should mention, though this is a very interesting story, and if you want, I'll go into it later, but let me just note that the United States, contrary to what everyone says, left and right, contrary to what virtually everyone says, the United States achieved its major objectives in Indochina. That was a partial victory for the United States. No successes in Indochina will infect the region. The kind of economic and social development that American planners were very much afraid of in the late 1950s and early 60s, particularly in South Vietnam, and remember, South Vietnam was the main target of the American attack throughout, and the United States won its war against South Vietnam. Demolished. No successes there will infect the region. In fact, these countries will be lucky to survive. And post-1975 U.S. policy has, in fact, been designed to maximize repression and suffering in the countries that were devastated by U.S. violence. Meanwhile, the degree of the cruelty of this is quite astonishing if you look at the details. For example, when the Mennonites tried to send pencils to Cambodia, the State Department stopped them. When Oxfam tried to send 10 solar pumps, government stopped them. When religious groups tried to send shovels to Laos to try to dig up some of the unexploded ordnance left by the American bombing, the government tried to stop them. When India tried to send 100 buffalo to Vietnam to replace the huge buffalo herds that were destroyed by the American attack, and remember, this is a primitive country. Buffaloes means fertilizer, tractors, and so on. The United States threatened to cancel food for peace aid. That's one that Orwell would have appreciated. If India sent 100 buffalo to Vietnam, and so on. Meanwhile, while the United States was extirpating the cancer at its source, the threat of successful development in South Vietnam and elsewhere at its source, it buttressed what was called the second line of defense, for example, by supporting the Suharto takeover in Indonesia with some 500,000 killed in a few months in 1965, backing the overthrow of Philippine democracy in 1972, supporting martial law in South Korea, again in 1972, again under Carter in 1980, and so on. Well, in accordance with the reigning geopolitical conceptions, right at the end of World War II, the United States turned at once to dealing with the problem faced, with a major problem faced by the population of the world, which had been politicized by the war, namely the problem faced by the anti-fascist resistance. The anti-fascist resistance in the liberated regions had to be suppressed, and the United States turned to that task globally, often suppressing it in favor of Nazi and fascist collaborators. This, in fact, is a major theme of early post-war history, which is barely discussed. It ought to be chapter one in an honest history of the post-war period, but you really have to look into the technical monographs to find it. What was the problem? Well, the primary concern is one that had been formulated by one of Winston Churchill's closest advisors, Jan Christian Smuts, a South African prime minister. He pointed out to Churchill in 1943 that with politics let loose among those peoples, we may have a wave of disorder and wholesale communism set going all over those parts of Europe. Communism, again, in the technical sense. Neither so-called communism, nor socialism, nor national capitalism was tolerable, and they had to be destroyed. The pattern was set in the first area liberated, North Africa, where President Roosevelt installed in power Admiral Jean Darlan, who was a leading Nazi collaborator and the author of the Vichy anti-Semitic laws. As U.S. forces advanced through Italy, they restored the essential structure of the fascist regime and dispersed the resistance, which had fought courageously against six Nazi divisions. In Greece, British troops entered after the Nazis had withdrawn. They imposed a corrupt regime which evoked renewed resistance, which Britain was unable to control in its post-war decline. The United States entered under the guise of the Truman Doctrine, launching the first major post-World War II war of insurgency, a very murderous war with maybe 160,000 killed, complete with torture, political exile for tens of thousands of people, re-education camps, as we called them, for tens of thousands of others, destruction of unions and any political independent politics, and the full range of means that were later used in similar exercises throughout the world, placing the country firmly in the hands of U.S. investors and local business elites, while in fact much of the population had to emigrate in order to survive. The beneficiaries again included Nazi collaborators, while the primary victims were the workers and the peasants of the communist-led anti-Nazi resistance. This, incidentally, was the model for what Adlai Stevenson called the U.S. defense against South Vietnam. He explained that to the United Nations in 1964, that our defense against internal aggression in Vietnam was modeled on our successful defense of Greece against its own population in 1947. And Reagan's advisors have used exactly the same model in talking about Central America. Well, the same pattern was followed elsewhere. It was a global pattern. In Korea, U.S. forces entered in 1945. They dispersed the local popular government, consisting of the anti-fascist resistance primarily, and they inaugurated a brutal repression using Japanese fascist police and Korean collaborators with the fascists. About 100,000 people were killed in South Korea prior to what we call the Korean War. That included 30 to 40,000 killed in the suppression of a peasant insurgency in one small region, Jeju Island. A fascist coup in Colombia, which was inspired by Franco's Spain, aroused no concern in the United States, no more than a military coup in Venezuela or the restoration of an admirer of fascism in Panama. But the first democratic government in the history of Guatemala, which modeled itself on Roosevelt's New Deal, elicited bitter U.S. antagonism and a CIA coup that turned Guatemala into a literal hell on earth, kept that way since, with regular U.S. intervention and support, particularly under Kennedy and Johnson, and including the Carter years, when, contrary to what is commonly alleged, U.S. military aid never ceased and was barely below the norm. Under Reagan, support for near genocide in Guatemala became positively euphoric, and the most extreme of these series of Guatemalan Himmlers that we backed there, Rios Montt, was lauded by Reagan as a man totally dedicated to democracy who was getting a bum rap, also lauded by Elliot Abrams, Gene Kirkpatrick, and other enthusiastic supporters of Pol Pot-style atrocities, which is in fact what was going on there at the time. With maybe 75,000 people slaughtered and others tortured and raped, etc., during that period, a couple of years. One aspect of this post-war project of suppressing the anti-fascist resistance, often in favor of fascist collaborators, one aspect of it was the recruitment of war criminals, people like Klaus Barbie. He had been responsible, the Butcher of Lyon, as he's called. He was responsible for many crimes in France, so he was naturally placed in charge of spying on the French for U.S. intelligence. The reasons for this were cogently explained by Barbie's superior, Colonel Eugene Kolb of U.S. intelligence. He noted that Barbie's skills were badly needed, he said, I'm quoting, "To our knowledge, his activities had been directed against the underground French Communist Party and the resistance, just as we in the post-war era were concerned with the German Communist Party and activities inimical to American policies in Germany." That's right, the comment is quite apt. The United States was picking up where the Nazis had left off, and it was therefore entirely natural that they should employ specialists in anti-resistance activities. Later on, when it became difficult or impossible to protect these useful folk in Europe, many of them were spirited off to the United States or to Latin America, with the help of the Vatican and fascist priests. There they have engaged in terrorism, coups, the drug and armaments trade, training the apparatus of the US-backed national security states modeled on the Nazis in Latin America, training them in methods of torture devised by the Gestapo, and so on. Some of their students have found their way to Central America, establishing a direct link between the death camps and the death squads via the U.S.-SS post-war alliance. Now, I can't run through the whole record case by case, but let me mention a few general points. We might ask how well George Kennan's precepts were followed. Recall George Kennan, the dovish advice, again in top secret documents, that in order to maintain the disparity, we put aside all concern for vague and unrealistic ideas such as human rights, the raising of the living standards, and democratization. How well have we lived up to that? Well, it's an empirical question, and it has indeed been studied. So if you take human rights, there are studies relating human rights, the human rights climate, to American aid, and there's a correlation, an impressive correlation. Let me quote from Lars Schultz, who's the leading U.S. academic specialist on human rights in Latin America. He discovered in one study that U.S. aid has tended to flow disproportionately to Latin American governments which torture their citizens to the hemisphere's relatively egregious violators of fundamental human rights. Furthermore, he shows the correlation is strong, includes military aid, extends through the Carter years, and is unexplained by any relation between aid and need. These facts, you might think, would be of some concern to people who care about their country. They're supported by other studies. I'll come back to what they mean later on if you like. Let's turn to the raising of the living standards. Now, quite regularly, in areas of predominant U.S. influence, such as Latin America, there has been statistical growth in the course of what are called economic miracles, while much of the population starves as croplands are diverted to export production for the benefit of U.S. agribusiness and local elites. That's true throughout Central America. Increased agricultural production, lower consumption on the part of the population. The United States is the world's largest food importer, primarily from the Third World, including the poorest and most hungry countries of the Third World. The United States is also the leading food exporter, primarily to advanced industrial societies, or for such projects as producing beef for export to U.S. markets, including replacing local subsistence agriculture. Kennedy's Alliance for Progress gave a significant impetus to these destructive, in fact, if we were honest, murderous developments. And there's a corollary to the Alliance for Progress style of development. It's necessary to institute terror and torture states with an efficient apparatus of repression to suppress the popular opposition that develops when you pursue such development policies. This too has been done primarily by the Kennedy administration. The Kennedy administration made a fateful decision. It changed the mission of the Latin American military from hemispheric defense to internal security, which means war against their own populations, and it provided the institutional structures, the means, and the training to carry out this mission. The structure of the death squads in El Salvador, for example, was established at that time. Countries that have attempted to reverse the pattern, such as Guatemala under the democratic capitalist regime of Arevalo and Arbenz, or the Dominican Republic under the also democratic capitalist regime of Bosch or Nicaragua today, naturally they are the target of U.S. hostility and violence. As for democratization, the historical record reveals exactly what a rational observer would expect. If you look at the case of, say, Guatemala in 1954, where a democratic capitalist government was overthrown by a CIA coup, or 1963, when Kennedy backed a military coup to prevent the threat of renewed democracy, or Chile, or the Dominican Republic in 1963 or 1965, and many others, you will discover that U.S. elites have consistently opposed formal parliamentary democracy, if its results cannot be controlled. And they have evinced outright hatred for democracy at home as well, incidentally, if by democracy we mean a system that allows the mass of the population to participate in some meaningful way in the formation of state policy. These facts, incidentally, have not gone unnoticed by serious scholars. So in a study for the Royal Institute of International Affairs in London, Gordon Connell Smith, this is the main scholarly study of the Inter-American system, he points out that while paying lip service to the encouragement of representative democracy in Latin America, the United States has a strong interest in just the reverse. Apart from procedural democracy, especially the holding of elections, which only too often have proven farcical. The reason is, he says, that the United States has been concerned with fostering the most favorable conditions for her private overseas investment, and the problem is that democracies are likely to fall prey to the heresy detected by U.S. intelligence, which I mentioned earlier, that is the belief that governments should be responsible for their own population instead of the needs of Big Brother, and that makes it more difficult to maintain the disparity. Well, the recent history of the United States in Central America illustrates all of these themes. Time being brief, I won't go into discussing the official reasons that are offered for the U.S. terrorist war against Nicaragua. Let me just mention some obvious truths. One obvious truth is that the United States is desperately trying to drive the Sandinistas into the hands of the Soviet Union. That's a classic pattern. We do it every time there's a threat of independence somewhere and we can't control it, drive them into the hands of the Russians, because that gives us an excuse to destroy them, since they're now proxies of the great Satan. And that's being done very consciously. So we block all support from other countries, like, say, France, and we send what the government itself calls a terrorist proxy army in internal documents to attack them, and then surprisingly they rely on the Russians. So now they're an outpost of the evil empire, so now we have a right to destroy them. It's a classic pattern. Many people pretend not to understand it, but it happens all the time and it's completely rational. Why are we doing it? Well, the real reason, as distinct from the obviously fraudulent reasons, are given, for example, by the Inter-American Development Bank, or the World Bank, which pointed out in the early 1980s, 1982 and 83, after 3 or 4 years of the Sandinista rule, that there had been remarkable socioeconomic progress, which was laying the basis for extensive development. There had been a very significant rise in production of food for local needs, subsistence agriculture, in enormous increase in health standards, in literacy, in engagement of the population in development process. And I'm now quoting, this is the World Bank, and which identified its projects in Nicaragua as some among its most successful projects, without a smidgen of corruption, they said, and so on. The real reasons for the attack against Nicaragua are explained by the charitable development organization Oxfam, the major charitable development organization which works in many parts of the third world. Oxfam America points out that among the four countries of Central America where Oxfam America works, namely El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, and Nicaragua, only in Nicaragua has a substantial effort been made to address inequities in land ownership and to extend health, educational, and agricultural services to poor peasant families. But the Contra war has slowed the pace of social reform and compounded the burden in the countryside, leading to hunger and a return to earlier conditions, so that now Americans who are enthusiastic supporters of starvation and torture can point to those failures as a justification for further atrocities, as they regularly do. This was all a major success for the United States. The parent organization of Oxfam in London goes still further. They say, from Oxfam's experience of working in 76 developing countries, Nicaragua was to prove exceptional in the strength of the government's commitment to improving the condition of the people and encouraging their active participation in the development process, citing also reports of the Inter-American Development Bank and the World Bank and so on and so forth, and giving many examples. This, incidentally, is in a pamphlet called Threat of a Good Example, which puts its finger exactly on the issue. American government officials sometimes concede the point. So Julia Preston, one of the best Central America correspondents, quotes key U.S. officials as saying that while they do not believe the Contras can drive out the Sandinistas soon, key American officials say, administration officials say, they are content to see the Contras debilitate the Sandinistas by forcing them to divert scarce resources towards the war and away from social programs. That's very crucial, because it's the social programs that are the threat of a good example, which might infect others, spread dissidence, and cause erosion of the American system of exploitation and robbery. I should say, incidentally, that these horrifying statements, you know, that the purpose of the statements by administration officials that the purpose of the war is to force them to divert resources away from social programs, those statements are made, listened to, and nobody reacts. That's an interesting comment on the moral level of American educated elites, the ones who read these comments. These, of course, are the main reasons for the attack on El Salvador, on Nicaragua, just as they were the main reason for the attack against South Vietnam in the late 1950s and the early 60s, then extending to a war against all of Indochina. Well, very much the same was true in El Salvador, very much the same. Everything was fine in El Salvador as long as it was just ordinary repression, torture, murder, and so on by the dictators of our choice. Nobody cared. So in 1972, there was an election in El Salvador. José Napoleón Duarte was elected. The election was stolen by the military. He was captured and tortured, finally released. He came to the United States. Nobody even wanted to talk to him. In fact, two senators were willing to talk, two congressmen, Kennedy and Harkin, were even willing to talk to him, and the press didn't care at all. That, incidentally, illustrates the utter contempt of American elites for democracy. As long as things are in order, no turmoil, profits are flowing, and so on. Same story continued in 1977. Same story took place in 1977. Nobody cared. Repression, torture, robbery, and so on continued perfectly fine. No concern here. There was, however, a concern, in fact, two concerns. One concern is that Somoza, who had been the base for American power in the region for many years, was under attack, and it looked like he couldn't be sustained, though the Carter administration did try to sustain him till the very end, and after failing, immediately reconstituted the National Guard to attack Nicaragua. But it looked like he couldn't be sustained, and there was fear that the dictator of El Salvador might go the same way. However, there was a second danger, which was even more threatening. In the 1970s, there was a growth in El Salvador of what were there called popular organizations. Many of them were church-based, Bible study groups that became self-help groups, peasant associations, cooperatives, unions, and so on. That raised the threat of democracy. It's under such conditions that the danger of democracy, the crisis of democracy, emerges. So how did we react? Well, that's interesting. In February 1980, there's no time to go through all the details, but the essence is the following. In February 1980, the Archbishop of El Salvador, Archbishop Romero, sent a letter to President Carter in which he pleaded with Carter not to send military aid to the military junta. The reason, he said, is that that military aid will be used to destroy the people's organizations which are fighting to defend their fundamental human rights. The army, he said, knows only how to serve the oligarchy and their interests and will destroy the popular organizations, which was, of course, exactly the point. Carter sent the aid knowing precisely what would happen. In March, the archbishop was assassinated. A state of siege was established, which has been renewed monthly since. The war against the population began in force. José Napoleón Duarte moved in to serve as a cover, which is the role that he has played ever since, the legitimizing cover to ensure that the massacre would continue and that the U.S. would support it, that Congress would support it. He had no illusions about what was going on. As he later said, the masses were with the guerrillas at that time. That was March 1980 when the archbishop was assassinated. The war against the peasantry began a few months later in May. With the first major attack was a big massacre at the Rio Sumpul, coordinated military operation of the Honduran and Salvadoran armies, in which at least 600 people were killed in a very brutal way. There happened to be a lot of church observers there, so the information came out immediately. Women were tortured and drowned. The infants were cut to pieces with machetes. Pieces of bodies were found in the river for days afterwards. That was all suppressed by the American media, incidentally. They literally did not mention it for 15 months and still have yet to report it. In fact, peasants were the leading victims of the Carter-Duarte war in that year, in which about 10,000 were killed. In October, late October, the successor of the assassinated archbishop, Bishop Rivera y Damas, condemned what he called the war of extermination and genocide against the defenseless civilian population. And a few weeks later, Duarte hailed the same armed forces who were conducting the war of extermination and genocide. He hailed them for what he called their valiant service alongside the people against subversion. This all throughout he'd been in the junta. Now, this was as he was sworn in as president of the junta. That was after the murder and rape of four American church women by the security forces. That was considered a little too much in the United States. You can kill 10,000 Salvadorans, but I don't want to go too far. And it was necessary to legitimate the government and allow the slaughter to continue. So Duarte was, he agreed, he chose to move in as the cover and become president of the junta at that time with those words. Under Reagan, the slaughter escalated with the direct participation of the U.S. Air Force, based in sanctuaries, coordinating bombing strikes, and so on. I won't go through the details, but by and large, it's been successful. The population, the popular organizations were destroyed, as the assassinated archbishop predicted. This is one of the most sordid episodes in U.S. history, and it's got a lot of competitors. About 50 or 60,000 people were slaughtered by conservative estimates. There are more than a million refugees. Finally, when the country was sufficiently traumatized, an election was run. The British Parliamentary Human Rights Group, which observed it, described it as an election carried out in an atmosphere of terror and despair, macabre rumor and grisly reality. Of course, the American press exulted in this, just as reporters from Pravda do under comparable circumstances. Let me stress again that none of this is ordinary killing, either in El Salvador or in Guatemala or by our terrorist army in Nicaragua. This is brutal, sadistic torture, cutting people's heads off and putting them on stakes to intimidate others, hanging women by their feet with their breasts cut off and their facial skin peeled back so they bleed to death, decapitating, beating infants to death against rocks. You know, this is Pol Pot-style torture. It amounts to somewhere in the neighborhood of 200,000 people in the last 7 or 8 years, if we count the Somoza's atrocities in Nicaragua, also supported by the United States. And it has led to great acclaim in the United States. Just read the reports about El Salvador. There's enthusiastic acclaim across the board, in particular by liberal elites, as the torture is achieving its ends. That tells us something about ourselves if we want to learn. Throughout, the threat has been that of a good example. Now, that follows from guiding geopolitical conceptions, understandable and rational, and we should not be mistaken about it. The concern over the threat of a good example follows from the guiding geopolitical considerations that I mentioned before. Under a corollary that we might call the rotten apple theory, I'm now adopting the terminology that's used by planners from Secretary of State Dean Acheson in the late 40s to the present. The problem is that one rotten apple may infect the barrel, as they put it. The rot may spread, the rot being social and economic development that might be successful in a framework that constrains the crucial right to rob and to exploit. These countries might be a virus that would infect the region, as Kissinger said about Allende, and it's got to be stopped. Greece, Guatemala, Vietnam, Cuba, Chile under Allende, and others have evoked similar fears with responses ranging from terrorism and subversion to mass slaughter. Well, let me just say a word about security policy since it's late, and I don't want to leave the topic unmentioned. Main point to bear in mind about security policy is that security, there's a dirty little secret about it, security is not a concern of planners. It's a very marginal concern at best. In fact, the historical and documentary record reveals this with very great clarity. There was not a concern about a Soviet invasion of Europe in the late 1940s or the early 50s or elsewhere. Rather, the concerns have been exactly what was expressed by the CIA documents that I quoted. The concerns have been internal aggression, and in more recent years, the threat of other rising centers of power, such as Japan. There is no doubt that each of the superpowers would much prefer that the other would disappear, but they have long understood that this is impossible, short of mutual annihilation, and they've settled into a system of global management called the Cold War, in which each superpower, as I said, appeals to the threat of the global enemy to justify violence and subversion and terror and aggression in its own domains, which for us happens to be much of the world. Any such act is self-defense against the great Satan. It's a standard technique of mass mobilization throughout history. In the United States, this is rather clear from the documentary record. There are two fundamental reasons for it, and they are expressed, even in the open record in this case, if you care to look. One fundamental reason is that it is, why do we have this huge increase, constant increase in strategic armaments? Why don't we stop? Why don't we accept an end to it, given the threat? First reason is that an intimidating posture is necessary to ensure that intervention can proceed under what is called the nuclear umbrella with impunity. So here's Harold Brown, Secretary of Defense under the Carter administration, in his last presentation to Congress in 1980. He explained, with our strategic capabilities in place, our other forces become meaningful instruments of military and political power. Intervention, subversion, etc., is possible, in other words, if our strategic nuclear forces are in place to intimidate everyone, make sure no one intervenes. President Reagan's arms control advisor, Eugene Rostow, said essentially the same thing at about the same time. Here's what he said. Our nuclear forces provide a nuclear guarantee for our own interests in many parts of the world and make it possible for us to defend those interests by diplomacy or the use of theater military force. They provide a shield for us to pursue our global interests by conventional means or theater forces, that is, intervention, subversion, clients, and mercenary states, and so on. This goes all the way back in the early 50s, in secret National Security Council memoranda, Paul Nitze and others were saying exactly the same thing. They were saying in order to carry out our Cold War policies of intervention and subversion, we must be protected from any threat. We must have what amounts to a nuclear umbrella. That's one major reason. There's a second major reason. I've already hinted at it. The Pentagon system has long been the technique by which the state mobilizes public resources to subsidize advanced sectors of industry. Now, there are very good reasons, which business elites, incidentally, have articulated very clearly since the late 1940s, as to why these methods are to be preferred over other devices of public subsidy for so-called private enterprise. Contrary to what's often said, the beneficiaries are not primarily military industry, rather general high technology industry. So take, say, computers, the foundation of any modern society. In the 1950s, when computers were not commercially marketable, they were paid for by the public. The public paid for the cost of the costly period of research and development and early production through the military system in the 1950s. In the 1960s, when computers became marketable, it was handed over to so-called private enterprise, which had already been subsidized so that they could make the profits. And that continues right now. So the so-called fifth generation computers, next big computer development, that's funded virtually entirely by the public through the Pentagon, NASA, which is basically a Pentagon-related enterprise, and the Department of Energy in connection with the production of nuclear weapons. And the same is true of a wide range of other advanced technologies. The so-called Star Wars, SDI, its expenditures correspond quite closely to those of Japan's state-coordinated industrial system, which the United States is unable to duplicate directly for a variety of social and historical reasons. In fact, SDI is perfect. It spurs the arms race. It subsidizes advanced industry, high technology industry. It maintains international confrontation. It also happens to be extremely dangerous for American security, and the alleged purposes can be attained, in fact, costlessly by a comprehensive test and missile ban, but that's irrelevant because security is not a concern, certainly not a primary concern. Now, if you understand these things, the main driving factors in the arms race, you can very well understand and predict, in fact, U.S. policies on arms control and related matters. The comparative advantage of the United States is not production any longer, rather technological innovation. So the United States will welcome reduction of nuclear armaments, which is a matter of minor importance in any event, since a tiny fraction of existing arsenals could cause totally unacceptable destruction. And it will do that. We'll always be delighted to have the level of armaments decreased as long as two fundamental conditions are met. One, we've got to maintain an intimidating posture which permits the free exercise of intervention, subversion, and so on. That's got to remain in place. And the Pentagon system of forced public investment for the benefit of high technology industry, that must not be challenged. Perfect negotiating position is Star Wars combined with build down. It's a natural stance given the policy imperatives, and appropriate strategic doctrines can be designed at will given the nature of strategic theory, and that's what's done. Meanwhile, debates over the feasibility of missile defense, the choice of missiles, and so on, they will proceed along their largely irrelevant paths while the race towards destruction goes on. Now, it's sometimes argued that this planning is lunatic, and it's true, but it's totally irrelevant. In government, as in business, planning is short run. It's a short range system. You don't have long term planning. The longer term is someone else's concern. If you think about it, you'll notice that that's quite natural in a competitive society where those who do not devote themselves to short term advantage are unlikely to be around in the long run. And these same attitudes are taken over when the same corporate managers become state planners. So we should not at all be surprised at the fact that in the 1950s, the United States made no effort to terminate the development of ICBMs, which were the only weapons that could threaten it. We should not be surprised that missile gaps and windows of vulnerability open and shut independently of any facts. We should not be surprised that Reagan's SDI was advanced with no Pentagon contribution. And no strategic motive, that's known incidentally, all of that came later, and that it is pursued regardless of the threat to survival. These factors are not the concern of planners. Rather, their concern is to maintain the disparity, to prevent rotten apples from infecting others, to ensure the crucial right to rob and to exploit, and to guarantee the domestic system of public subsidy and private profit called free enterprise. Now, the public may express overwhelming support for a nuclear freeze and cuts in military rather than social spending, as in fact it does, but this too is an irrelevance, as is the clear feasibility of a nuclear freeze, a comprehensive test ban, a ban on missile testing, and other measures which would surely enhance the possibilities of survival and be very beneficial to the security of the United States. As every serious study of the American political system recognizes, the public has little voice in such matters, and public opinion is of no more concern to elite groups that control the state apparatus than security or survival or human rights, the raising of the living standards, and democratization. Not only the people of Latin America, but also those of the rest of the world, including the United States, are an incident, not an end, in the words that so impressed Woodrow Wilson. This is not because the leadership are bad people, and none of it is likely to change very much if better people take their place. The reasons are institutional, and the problems should be confronted without illusions, with understanding of the social realities. Thank you.